the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average losing over 1,000 points in a single week. Another terrorist attack on U.S. soil on Friday. The markets are in turmoil. Does this bode well for the markets ahead? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Ralph Ancampora will be joining us. Ralph is short-term bearish, long-term bullish. You're going to want to listen to his reasons why. He'll be joining us in the first hour. Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman will also be here. He'll be talking about China, the dollar, a lot of the main stories that have been impacting this market for throughout 2015 are impacting this market in 2016. All of that, plus Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour number one.
And I'm John Loeffler. Happy New Year to everyone. We're going to follow our time-honored tradition here on the Financial Sense News Hour, which we've done since 1793 when we started this program. And that is, we have a two-parter, which has actually three parts in it, predictions for the year to come. And what the show today will revolve around in the big picture is predictions on the part of the street and on the part of those people who are what we call outliers or rogue predictors, and sometimes they get it more right than the consensus on the street. So that'll all be the big picture today. Next week is the day for the third part, and that will be our own predictions here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But it's going to be an exciting program after we started this whole week off with a tremendous roaring yawn, right? Don't you wish? No, in reality, it was a pretty big jump start to 2016, and we have to say, not a good one at that. The Santa Claus rally fizzled at the end of the year, so maybe it's no surprise that the start of the year was so sour. You know, I understand that the Chinese economic numbers and the peg resets for the yuan have been upsetting U.S. investors here. So to make sense of everything that's been going on this week, could you help us a bit, Ryan? I mean, is it just August all over again?
Hi, John. Yeah, I would say Happy New Year, but investors probably aren't feeling that happy unless they're on the sidelines. And I have heard actually some reports that investors are less exposed to equities this month than they were in August, which, you know, should help in any correction being a little bit more orderly than it was in August. But, you know, as they say, selling does beget selling. And this week was no exception. You know, technically, some supports were holding at 1990 throughout the week for the S&P 500 until Thursday's open, you know, just sliced right through it like a hot knife through butter.
Yeah, well, you know, the S&P 500 shaved off 120 points this week with that little knife you're talking about. So what's the underlying catalyst for it?
Yes, China's economy and the regulatory machine that we saw really out of whack over the past 6 months. There's been a lot of concerns over, you know, what kind of policy decisions are they making there to try and fix things. And yes, it's also the weakness in oil, despite some tensions we saw actually even on like Monday, oil was up, the market was down between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And yes, it's also these technical support levels I just mentioned, you know, they're breaking down. And, you know, I think the other very major catalyst here behind the scenes, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that here, is the U.S. economic numbers. You know, yeah, the jobs report on Friday on the surface was great, but employment is a lagging indicator. So you got to look at some more leading indicators, like some of the manufacturing numbers, the non-manufacturing numbers that we get each month, the regional numbers we get from the different regional feds. We got a number of different catalysts this week that suggest the fourth quarter GDP number will end the year on a sour note. I heard many trading desks saying that their research outfits were lowering their numbers for the fourth quarter based on some of the numbers we saw this week. The ISM manufacturing data number was one of them. That continues to contract at a reading of 48.2. Anything below 50 is a contraction. And that was for December. But it's been dropping each consecutive month since June. The other side, the non-manufacturing side, continues to also show that, yes, it's expanding with a reading of 55.3, but it's actually actually been slowing for the past 5 months. So, you know, even though construction spending, also something else I was looking at on that came out on Monday, was up 10.5 versus a year ago. So that's a great number overall. I think long term, real estate still looks great. Construction spending still looks great. Multifamily units construction has been really good recently. If the market's right now really looking at U.S. numbers through a magnifying glass, the numbers were down month over month from October, and that drop was around 0.4%. So, you know, we also see here that in the manufacturing and power component of construction, spending has declined for 5 months. So that's also matching what we're seeing in the manufacturing numbers, and that's important. So, John, even though the long-term picture looks really good for real estate, the Wall Street Journal took note of the drop. Other analysts took note of it. And like I said, they're readjusting their expectations for the fourth quarter down for GDP. You know, the other major item, if we're looking at catalysts here on the week, was comments by AutoNation on Wednesday that came, you know, the day after we saw the auto sales data on Tuesday. And the sales there, we showed a drop in the annual rate. It was 18.2 million units. And at the end of, I believe, November, it's been seasonally adjusted now at 17.3 million. So a drop below consensus, a drop below the previous month. That was not a great thing to see. The CEO came out the following day of AutoNation saying, basically warned of a glut in luxury cars. And he said that the great gains that the company made, it was like 9% growth year over year, which is great. He said that a lot of that was propped up by significant discounts. And he said actually a few more selling days last year compared to 2014. So he said kind of some short-term issues here that helped prop that up, that likely it's not going to still be there in the near future. So, you know, with the earnings season just around the corner, investors are really cautious about the U.S. And we also had some warnings by Cirrus Logic and a couple other Apple suppliers, also warning of lower sales coming with the earnings season just around the corner. I think people have been nervous this week, and that probably played into some of the selling, as well as the angst with the Chinese market at the open and oil jitters ongoing.
Well, yeah, you can look at the economic numbers with that glass is half full type of perspective. But, you know, I don't think even the most bullish of investors can deny that the rate of change really looks bad on some of these indicators.
Right. As I mentioned, and right now, the only positive has been employment. I mean, the positive is still there in real estate long term, positive still there in the services sector and consumption. But if you look closer at the employment data, something a lot of bears always look at right now and have been is looking at the U6 unemployment rate, which basically takes into account anybody that's underemployed. Yes, you want, you're working right now, maybe working 30 hours a week, but maybe you want to work 40. You want to work more hours than you're able to. And they look at that as underemployment. And marginally attached workers is still relatively high. Both of those combined with the unemployed, 9.9% is that unemployment rate. And that's been unchanged over the last couple of months. So the futures market was up big on the news for the employment data on Friday and also on China being up Friday. But that gave way to selling, especially in the last hour, John, on Friday, when yet again, another economic number came out. The consumer credit number showed slowing growth of only 14 billion credit expansion in November versus there was expectations for 18.5. So a tad lower there. And also October got revised lower down to 15.7 billion. So November at 14, that's below October, it's 15.7, yet another number that disappointed. And so we dropped another 14 points on the day to end the week, really on a sour note, unfortunately.
All right, Ryan, what I'd like to do is talk more about China, since a lot of the correction that we saw was blamed for trading that was happening there. And we've been hearing hard landing stories for years concerning China's economy. There's always concern that we're not maybe being told the whole story. I mean, you have a centrally governed nation such as China with the communist Chinese government intervening and things. So in reality, in your opinion, how worried should we be over their markets and also the drop in the yuan relative to U.S. stocks?
Well, I think if you talk about China and the hard landing stories that we've had for years, you know, they have been in decline in manufacturing and, you know, commodity based areas that we see this demand for commodities has been dropping for, gosh, 4 years now. So hard landing, I think hardly, but definitely it's been in decline. There's no doubt about it. There's no question about it. I don't think you can really paint a rosy picture there on the manufacturing side. But as we know from a essentially regulated economy, they've been trying to move more and more into consumption and away from investment. So you look at some of the other sides of their economy, like their services, it actually represents now over 50% of their GDP. So have they been successful there? I'd say yes. But you know, right now, the drop in the yuan and the Chinese equity market has served as a proxy for the global economy. So some of the angst has to do with confusion about the regulatory environment there, as well as the uncertainty of these currency adjustments. Just where is the yuan going to fix on a day-to-day basis? You know, looking at Wednesday, it was adjusted down 0.5%. And that's the biggest drop since August. So there was concern at the beginning of the week that we were seeing this rate float down. And here we go, another big drop. So there was a lot of concern over that. And then there's this sense that the Chinese don't have a handle on how to stabilize their markets. The circuit breakers that were implemented in December were used on Monday and again on Thursday. And Thursday specifically, the first 15 minutes triggered a circuit breaker when the CSI index fell about 5%. That triggered the first circuit breaker. We got a halt of 15 minutes and then they reopened and the market dropped all the way to 7%, triggering the final halt for the day. And, you know, instead of calming investors, instead, that's what the whole idea is behind the circuit breakers. Hey, calm down. Let's allow the market makers to reevaluate where supply and demand is, reopen at where we think equilibrium should be. And, you know, that should create some calming for investors. But actually what it does is it creates more panic because you as an investor, think about it. If you're trying to sell some shares in the Chinese market, you're a new person to the whole process over the last year or so. You're trying to get out of your stock. All of a sudden you're finding out that at the rate of decline, you're most likely not going to be able to continue to sell what you're trying to do. Market gets halted. Now you can't sell. This produces this panic feeling and you just panic and exit for the doors as quickly as possible. You got to get those shares out as funds and et cetera are trying to get out. And it just creates a worse situation. So, you know, should we be worried? You know, overall, John, just for stocks globally, I think yes, China's manufacturing continues to slow. So again, if we're looking at the decline in the markets there as a proxy for the economy, yes, it's slowing manufacturing, but you know, they're trying to replace that with services and consumption. And again, like I said, we're seeing signs there that they're doing much better there and progress is being made. And now it's over 50% of GDP.
So Ryan, if we were to remain a dedicated bull in philosophy here, what are the key factors that all of those dedicated bulls would need for, well, at least on their side, for stocks to head back up again?
You know, John, I think the main two catalysts, which we've been looking at since December, and I've been talking about it on the show quite a bit, is earnings, which a lot of that has been hurt by the rise in the dollar, which is hurting the multinationals and their exportation of goods. And then I think the other one, oil stability as well. Those are two very key factors. But now I think with everything that's gone on in the yuan, circuit breakers, et cetera, it's financial stability. And we've been looking at our risk indicators on the credit markets. And over the last few months, they've been elevated and they continue to move higher here this week. A number of those indicators are the TED spread, the LIBOR to OIS spread, credit default swaps on investment grade corporates and commercial paper, high yield as well. You know, all these are showing that there's more stress here, not to the extent of 2008, but in some cases like the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index, that's above levels we saw in 2011 when we had a pretty sizable correction in the market. So it may not be the best time to be 100% in equities. You know, it seems buyers are having a hard time stepping in yet. You know, we just broke below some key support levels on Thursday. And, you know, don't forget the blackout that many companies have in their buying programs ahead of the earnings season. That just starts next week. So technically, new areas of weakness are even developing. Again, like I said, with the supports breaking in the S&P, you know, look at some of the tech areas that a lot of investors have been hiding out in over the past few months, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. What is it? Alphabet Soup now. And, you know, traders are booking in profits in the new year. You know, they were waiting all at the end of last year to do that so they don't have to deal with their whole realized gains for another 12 months. But we're also seeing weakness in financials, which we've been saying that the yield curve is flattening, probably because the Chinese are selling yuan, $4. And where are they putting that money? U.S. Treasuries, most likely. So, you know, bulls need to see oil stabilize as well as global equities. And we need to see financial conditions stabilize as well. You know, technically, the next area I'm looking at for some buying entry by the market and investors is 1850 on the S&P 500, which was that October low in 2014. And then 1867, that was the August low last year. So those are the two areas I'm looking at. And, you know, with the days we saw this week, unfortunately, we're almost there.
Well, it's time to look forward to what we are surveying for the coming week. And please, Ryan, tell me something other than everyone speculating on whether or not the Fed is going to raise interest rates. What are we looking forward to next week?
Yeah, John said next week, it's the start of the earnings season. So, you know, with the warnings we saw this week, information from AutoNation about auto sales and possibly being a glut there in luxury cars. Next week's going to be interesting. We'll hear from some major bellwethers, Intel, Alcoa on the materials side, and many others in the financial side. So should be interesting, and definitely look forward to talking to you about it then.
Well, since China's been in the focus, old Chinese proverb, more like a curse, may you live in interesting times. Anyway, see you again next week, Ryan Poplava. Of course, that's what makes for good radio.
All right, we'll see you guys next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Probably not the best way to start out the year. Since the beginning of the year, the stock market has been down every single day. What's going on here? Is this the beginning of a bear market, or is this another correction similar to what we had this summer? Joining me on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, as I'm looking at the Dow here, we had that steep drop-off that we had in August. We came back up, but the rallies up are lower than where we were during the summer. What's going on here? What is this telling you? Is this the beginning of a bear market?
Jim, that's a good observation, because I was going to say you can't look at 2016 unless you look at 2015. And you hit it right on the head. We've had a series of failed rallies throughout most of 2015. My old indicator, the Dow theory itself, had been flashing for months and months that there was a problem, because transportation average kept making lower lows. In fact, the tranny is down over 20% right now. So I think this China news, this North Korea news, should not be taken as an excuse for the beginning of something negative. The narrowness of the market in 2015 and so, and I think you've created a major top in the markets. I'm very concerned here.
You know, one of the characteristics of a topping process is fewer troops follow the generals up the hill. And last year was the year of what they call FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And those stocks kind of masked underlying weakness that we saw developing since the summer, because the vast majority of stocks, Ralph, are actually in their own bear markets, meaning they're down over 20% or more.
Yes, Jim, that's called market breadth. The advanced decline line has been out of sync, kind of like the Dow Transportation Index. It peaked earlier and has been unable to make new highs. The market in 2015 has been very, very narrow, and many stocks are already down 20% or more. So the internals are not attractive at all.
So when you take a look at if this is a bear market, we have major bear markets, we have minor bear markets, you know, the bear market that we saw in 2000, the other one that developed in 2007. Most of the big major bear markets have been associated with the recession. Even though the U.S. economy is weakening right now, it doesn't look like we're in a recession. Can we talk about the characteristics of different bear markets, if indeed this is a new one?
I agree. Recession is usually the telltale sign of a nasty bear market, but I think in this day and age, we have factors outside of the market, outside of the economy, that are very, very scary. Start with the geopolitical problems around the world. You can point a finger at the Middle East. You can look at this thing going on now between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the influx of terrorism in Europe, what we have going on in the States. It's not a very good picture. So it's not just the economy or a recession that could bring this market down. I think the battle that we're having in currencies is also a negative impact on the equity market. So I think it's a confluence of a lot of factors.
You know, Ralph, when you take a look at 2015, it was probably one of the most difficult years to make money in the markets. If you were in bond funds, you probably lost money. If you were in commodities, you lost money. If you were in stock markets or stocks, you lost money. When you see all asset classes going down, how does one play a market like this? Are there sectors, are there safe havens other than cash?
No, I mean, you just took the word out of my mouth, cash. I said, there's nothing wrong with cash. Especially right now, if you notice in the last day or so, they're starting to really get to the ones that were leaders late last year, like technology and financials, and they're getting to them. So even the, quote, stronger ones, and there were only a handful of sectors that looked pretty good last year. No, I think it's playing a game of catch-up. Across the board, I think there's going to be a period of weakness. I don't want to sound like I'm super bearish long-term, because I'm not, but I think the first half of this year has got to be dedicated to unwinding what started last year. I think that's safe enough to say.
Yeah, because many of the same problems that the markets were worried about, a slowdown in China, geopolitical strife, falling oil prices, those same problems have carried forward into the new year. Oil prices are falling. Geopolitical strife is even heightened now, as you mentioned, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and of course, China.
You know, the old cliche, the stock market doesn't like uncertainties. My gosh, we got a list of uncertainties now.
And this year is also a political election year. And cyclically, what was amazing, historically, the third year of a presidential cycle is supposed to be the best. That was last year. Well, we know that didn't turn out that way. And then the fourth year is supposed to be not a really great year. So maybe we start that. You know, it seems to me like this is a market that needs some kind of catalyst. Either we're going to get some kind of catalyst that drive it down further. China devalues, the Fed raises interest rates, or we get some other kind of catalyst maybe later on in the year that drives it upward. Maybe the Fed reverses course, Congress comes up with a stimulus program, or maybe some of these uncertainties that we're worried about now clear themselves up.
Yeah, I would like to think that the uncertainties clear themselves up. But, you know, you really have to wait and see. I'm willing to sit back, raise the cash, and wait. I think that's the best bit of advice I can give anybody.
And, Ralph, when you say raise some cash, there's a tendency, I know there's one segment of the market that believes in market timing. In other words, you get out at the top, go 100% in cash, and then you get in at the bottom and deploy that cash. I haven't yet to meet somebody that has done that consecutively. So when you say raise cash, I don't think you are basically saying get completely out of stocks.
No, I'm not. For anyone that's listening, I'm assuming they have a bit of a technical bias. Go look at the long-term pictures. I'm talking about weekly and monthly bar charts of Apple, IBM. Okay, there are a whole host of stocks that have massive, massive tops. You know, you might want to accelerate some of that money out. And then the areas that don't look so bad or don't have that much of a downside, like utilities, telecommunications maybe, you can park your money in there somewhere for a while.
Yeah, because some of these stocks, I mean, when you take a look at interest rates, you know, typically in the past, you might have gone to some bonds, but with the Fed raising interest rates, there's a risk there. And even then, the bond yields just don't look that attractive. It's hard to believe that treasuries at maybe 2.25% look like junk bonds when you compare them to, let's say, yields on European sovereign debt. But what about some of the traditional safe haven type of investments, things like consumer staples, which many of them have some very nice dividends, or even utilities, or is there too much risk there?
No, I hear what you're saying, and I agree. You can go for those safe havens. You can park money in those, definitely. But they'll be a little bumpy. But by and large, yeah, fresh cash, I think I'd just sit on it for a while.
And Ralph, what are the signs that you would either, one, look for further confirmation that we indeed have begun a new bull market? That would be number one. And number two, if this bull market was to be short or come to an end, what kind of things would you like to see improve that would tell you we're out and free and clear of trouble?
Well, to make it very simple, I need new highs. I've been saying this for, a good 6 months or so. And every time we've had a rally, and we had a real good rally in October. I think it was the best October in 4 years. But it got short-circuited. The Fed raised rates, market got nervous, and all sorts of terrorist attack in France and Paris. You know, so we're too far down to say, well, all right, Ralph, let's make new highs. That's a long distance from here. So let's say, what would I like to see on the downside? The obvious thing is the August lows of last year. Remember August 24th when we had that 1,000.5-minute decline on the market? That is a pivotal low. You want the leading indexes. You want our leading averages to stay above that level. Maybe undercut them a little bit, but hold. That would be a very encouraging sign for me that maybe we're in the bottoming phase. So that's an easy thing to look at. You don't want to see it below that. Like the transportation average took out its August low a couple of days ago, and it just looks terrible.
Yeah, because on that day that you were talking about in August, where we got down to 15,400 almost on the Dow, today, as you and I are doing this show, we're at 16,683. So, you know, that's a big drop from here.
Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about from here to there, you could wash out a lot of the negatives. I actually think that would be very, very helpful.
And Ralph, could we see a situation kind of like what we saw between August and October, but pretty much like we did last year? Let's say we go down, maybe we don't touch the lows of August, but we just have this back and forth chop as we did throughout most of last year, where, you know, stocks would go up. We would have a couple of weeks where the market was looking good and positive, and then we'd give it all back. Could we just not only hit new lows, but then just go sideways until things work themselves out?
I don't think so. And the reason why I say that is we had a whole year of that. And for me, that's distribution, that's selling on balance. And you know what I'm a little concerned about, and I've seen it in the last couple of days, listening to the TV set and looking at some of the sentiment data, the volume is a lot less. And there doesn't seem to be any fear here. Like the battle cry for 2015 was buy the dips. I think people are too complacent with that attitude. I'm more in the camp sell the rally 2016. So I'd like to see a little bit more fear. You know, as we get to those August lows and people start panicking a little bit, I'll feel much more encouraged. We're drifting down. We're not drifting. We're falling apart here, and no one seems that worried. That bothers me. It seems like only technicians are talking negative. That's another very interesting observation. You said in the very beginning, a lot of technicians are nervous or bearish or whatever, and we have reason to be.
And when you see this take place, because I've read a lot of the forecasters, although it's interesting this year, you know, I always look at Byron Wien and some of the others, Doug Cass and others that always come up with their surprises for the year. And each one of them this year is talking about a bear market. So I found that rather interesting. It's very hard to find somebody that is extremely bullish. There's one or two of them out there, but not many.
I heard Jeremy Siegel on television a few minutes ago. He's still looking for 10%+ on the upside for the year. Good old Jeremy.
Yeah, I know. That would take a lot of stimulus or something to change dramatically, and it doesn't look like any of that's going to happen. So, Ralph, the takeaway here, it looks like, smells like a bear market. We don't know the extent of it. The real key thing to watch is, do we hit those August lows, which were for the Dow somewhere in the 15,400 range? Would you also be looking for some kind of divergences where maybe one index, maybe it's the transports or something else, starts to turn up?
Yeah, those are the things you'd want to see at the bottom. Yes, I don't see any of that. No positive divergences yet. Not at all.
So the message I hear, Ralph, is raise some cash. You don't want to be completely out of the stock market, but having some cash and sitting on the sidelines may not be a bad way to go right now until things clear up.
Just sit back and relax.
Well, listen, Ralph, I want to wish you a happy new year, wealth and prosperity to you and your family. And it was a pleasure having you on the program.
All right. Thanks again.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Pfau from American College. And Professor, let's begin with some of the changes because, I mean, those were some pretty big changes. And there wasn't a lot of discussion about it before those changes were made.
Right, yeah. Late last year, the Congress enacted some new proposals regarding some provisions that were created in the year 2000 that allowed for filing and suspending and different things. This will affect a limited number of people, but it became a really popular strategy to discuss in the popular culture. And last year, Larry Kotlikoff had, I think, the number 3 best-selling book on all of Amazon about Social Security claiming strategies. And he basically began the first chapter of his book with the strategy that's now being phased out. And that's some people who are going to use it and would have high Social Security benefits could potentially get up to around $50,000 of additional benefits that they'll no longer be able to receive. The idea was the higher earning spouse would file for their Social Security benefit at their full retirement age and suspend receiving it until age 70 so that they get those additional credits for delaying Social Security. But at the same time, their spouse could file a restricted application and receive 4 years of the spousal benefit while their spouse's benefit had been suspended. And that's not going to be possible anymore for people. There's a few different things going on, I think, for the most part, for people reaching the full retirement age after May 1st, 2016.
Mark Chandler joined us today. He's the Global Head of Currency Strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman. And Mark, there's a lot of things to talk about today. This week, we've seen already oil fall down to the low 30s. We're seeing some trouble in the currency markets, whether or not you're looking at the Mexican peso, the Russian ruble, the Canadian dollar, and a number of other currencies. It seems like anyone exposed to China or to oil is getting hit hard. What are your thoughts on the current investment landscape today?
Yeah, well, I think that we begin off the new year, of course, on just a horrible start to it for investors. Equities cratering, commodities still falling. And of course, as you say, the emerging markets are under a lot of pressure. A lot of people are blaming China for this. I think that it's partly China, but it's partly also an excuse for other things. But I do think that China has, they have a currency regime in which they set a fix. That's like a central reference rate every day. And that central reference rate then is the anchor which the dollar can trade at 2% on either side of that. And what China's been doing for 8 days in a row now is it's setting a central reference rate weaker for its currency. And this is after a period of stability after the summer turmoil. And so many people in the market are concerned that the combination of RMB, the Chinese currency weakening, sell-off in the Chinese stock market, is having a major risk-off impulse throughout the capital markets.
So translate this to how it's affecting the rest of the markets. Like you say, it's causing this sort of risk-off impulse. Why is it exactly that China allowing its currency to weaken, widening that trading ban, I think like you said, how is that exactly translating to a risk-off environment and selling and panic? What's the thinking? What's the flow from that to the U.S. and the rest of the global markets?
Sure. I think that's a good question because I don't think it's very scientific in the sense that I think that some of this is just fear and anxiety because the scar tissue from August is still so fresh on us. Remember what happened August 24th, Chinese stocks selling off after they devalued their currency a bit. And at one point on that August 24th, it looked like the U.S. Dow Jones was going to open up 1,000 points lower. And so I think that it's sort of like we've seen this movie before, and people are afraid of the same ending. And the same ending is, of course, what happens in China. It's almost like this old story, you know, we used to talk about U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches pneumonia. Now, partly I'd say because of the tide, how China is integrated in many emerging market economies, how it influences the commodity market as a marginal producer or buyer of these commodities, that when China sneezes right now, the knee-jerk reaction is to like bundle up and to worry that we're going to catch that cold. And I think that this is understandable, but knee-jerk reaction. And here's what I think that the real tell. Back on that August 24th, the VIX, which is a measure of S&P volatility, hit over 50%. Today, despite four big down days in the stock market, the U.S., despite the global issues, dropping oil prices, the China story, the VIX today is less than half of what it was in August. And the VIX is sometimes called the fear gauge, because when people are afraid, the volatility of the stock market goes up. And so I think what the stock market's telling us is, yes, we're nervous about what's happening in China, but this is a short-run phenomenon. And that's important for your listeners to keep in mind. Yesterday and today, senior Fed officials have stood by their December forecast, suggesting that four rate hikes over the course of this year is still appropriate. And so no backing off from the U.S. despite the volatility of the stock market.
Now, I think we would assume that given the fact that the Fed says they're so data dependent, if we were to see some major volatility greater than what they would expect, you know, they might back off that. But like you say, with what we've seen so far, they're still backing their story. They're still maintaining towards the tightening policy. Now, I want to note that with that said, we had you on in 2014 to talk about three major themes. And I just want to point out that everything that we see taking place today is really not new news. The themes that we see today, you were out in front talking about 2 years ago with three divergences you saw taking place. That was a divergence in monetary policies between the Fed and the rest of the world, falling commodity prices, and a continual slowing in China. Those three themes that you outlined there 2 years ago, are we really just seeing a continuation of these, a worsening of these? And now this is kind of the reality is now sort of just coming to roost and people are realizing this and waking up. Are we seeing a worsening of these trends, or is it just now a realization of them?
Yeah, no, good question. I didn't realize I was so smart a couple of years ago. I don't know what happened to me. I sort of think that these forces are still in play. But they're a little bit different in the sense that I'd say that with the Federal Reserve already raising interest rates, and think about the ECB cut interest rates 2 weeks before the Fed raised rates, the Bank of Japan has also stepped up their aggressiveness. So I think that the divergent story on monetary policy has continued, but has become more intense. And I suspect it will continue to be intense over the course of this year. The China slowdown story is still intact. I'd say a couple of little things have changed, and one is that the Chinese currency, and that's what I think ultimately is going on here. China is not letting its currency fall to boost exports. Exports in China are still falling on a year-over-year basis. Instead, I think something like this is happening. The Chinese economy, it's weakening, and it's going through both a cyclical slowdown and a structural transformation. And in order to facilitate this, make it smooth, China needs to have its own monetary policy. But what economists call the trilemma, which is having a fixed exchange rate, open capital markets, and independent monetary policy, economists say you can't have all three at the same time. What China needs now, what they think they need, is a more independent monetary policy. In order to pursue that, they've got to decouple or de-link their currency from the dollar. And so even though the dollar is strong against China, China's currency is still strong against most other currencies in the world over the last 6 months or a year, or different time periods. So China's currency is still strong even though it's fallen against the dollar. And the dollar, of course, is rallied against almost all the currencies except, say, over the last 6 months, maybe the Japanese yen. And so that is still in play. And, of course, this bearish cycle for commodities, continuing with oil making new 10 or 11, 12-year lows here, iron ore prices down, copper prices down, and that's partly a slowdown in China. Partly its producers are responding to the high prices of a few years ago, and they boosted production. So there's a real temporal lag between, now think about this, you see price of steel going up, so you decide to build a steel factory. Between the time you decide to build that factory until the time it's up and running could be several years. And this is what's happened in China. Many years ago, they decided to build a bunch of factories. Now those factories are coming online. There's not the same demand. The demand hasn't grown as much as they anticipated. And so I think that the imbalances on that global level that I call divergences, I think are still very much in play. And some of them have intensified, but it's continued to unfold.
Mark, do you think that we're at any sort of inflection point here when we look at some of the major drivers? I noticed you just said that the divergence monetary policy is still in play. You know, we have seen a continued fall in commodity prices. And of course, the slowing in China is unfolding as well. But, you know, when we look at some of the major currencies that I noted in the beginning, whether it's the Canadian dollar, whether it's the Aussie, which has been falling recently, the Mexican peso, the Russian ruble, we're seeing a lot of, I would say, fireworks in the currency market. Are we near any major inflection points as you see it when you see these major currencies falling? Do you expect to see these trends continue and to really put more of a risk-off environment in the minds of investors and lead to further selling?
Well, I do think that, you know, when you look at these currencies, there's been some very sharp moves. And like you say, Canada is at 10 or 11, 12-year lows against the U.S. dollar. The Mexican peso is at record lows. South African rand made new record lows today. I do think the emerging market currencies are under pressure. Partly, it is the China slowdown story, and that is that China is not buying a lot of the products from the EM that they used to. It's also some of these own imbalances in these countries. It's sort of almost like a movie that we've seen before. Here's typically what happens. U.S. begins, it says slow, that it's cut interest rates, and U.S. interest rates are lower than other countries. So these other countries, especially emerging markets, countries as well as companies, borrow dollars because they're cheaper. And then they repatriate that money back home, which is fine and good. They save the interest costs. They have a weakening, the dollar's falling. Everything works out fine until it doesn't. And that is, eventually, the dollar begins rising again, commodity prices begin falling, and then these countries and companies are left with a big currency mismatch. They borrow dollars, and when the dollar is weak, they can pay back those cheaper dollars, but now the dollar is getting stronger, and U.S. interest rates are rising. So I do think that emerging markets, it's almost like after a big love affair, it's broken up. Now you're heartbroken. And that's what's happening in the emerging markets. They're heartbroken. They thought they were integrated in the world economy. They had all these structural reforms. People poured tons of money, pension funds, hedge funds, mutual funds. And now they've fallen out of favor, partly as the cycle turns. So I think it's a bit early to begin trying to pick a bottom to these emerging markets. Remember that almost all the major emerging market crises in the last 40 or 50 years took place after the Federal Reserve began a tightening cycle. And because the dollar was in a bear market for so long, U.S. interest rates were so low for so long, that it let a lot of these pent-up excesses grow. And the unwind of this is very violent. And I think that's partly what's happening is an unwind and a readdressing of some of these imbalances, like currency mismatches that existed. I still am bearish oil prices. I saw that the inventories fell last week, but Cushing rose, and it seems like the lack of buildup of oil inventories was really replaced with, I think, almost a record build in gasoline inventories and another jump in the distillates, so the heating oil, jet fuel, diesel. Those inventories also jumped. So I'm concerned that the market is still not at a clearing price for oil. U.S. oil output is back to August levels. We had 4 or 5 month highs in oil production in the U.S. despite the drop. Russia's producing record amounts. OPEC seems to be having a race. For 2 years, they've been ramping up production, and Iranian output might not still fully be factored into the market, maybe the first couple of weeks of it. Over the long run, over, say, the course of the year, we're talking about last year, 2 million roughly extra units, extra barrels of oil being produced a day, 2 million. And now this year, it could be closer to 3 million. And so I think it's a bit early to pick a bottom to commodity prices, but I do think that these moves in the market are creating some short-term opportunities. I think that you can't predict the stock market for a year based on the first 4 days of January. I do think that some of these moves are excessive in the short run. But as longer-term investors, I would still be patient.
You know, it's interesting because if we were to see the trend for oil continue downward, like you say, you know, there's still a lot of overhang there in terms of supply and a lot of bearish factors that we can look at. If we were to see oil continue to move lower, I would imagine we're only going to see the junk bond space continue to deteriorate further. High correlation there. When we look at the JNK ETF or HYG, the high yield bond ETFs, we're only going to see the credit space deteriorate further. It seems like that would be putting pressure on the broader indices as well, which we're already seeing a lot of technical damage there. You know, we've had a number of technicians come on the show that have said the conditions that they see are quite bearish for the market. Luis Shimada is probably one person in particular that you're aware of saying that she's seen sell signals on all indices when we look at things technically. You said from a shorter term perspective, you know, we might see some counter trend rallies because conditions do get oversold, but long term, still be patient. So do you think we still see more damage ahead in the market this year?
Yeah, I think you're right about the oil price to continue to sell off. That's, of course, a lot of what we think is shale, and we're so proud of America becoming more energy self-sufficient and now be able to export oil. The fact of the matter is that the energy sector accounted for a lot of U.S. investment. That's hitting investment. That's hitting things like durable good orders. It's hitting the shipments of those. It's hitting industrial output. But also a lot of these shale producers is really another reason why it's so peculiarly American is not just because of our geological formations, but a lot of these companies was made possible by not only technology innovation, but also by financial innovation, getting some of these companies, some of them were like barely breaking even at $100 a barrel because they borrowed so much. And so I think of it as very much like the Minsky moment. Remember, 2 years ago, people were saying that oil could only go up because we had peak oil. We've got all the oil that we can. And in 2008, oil was at $160 a barrel, and people were bullish. And a lot of people made business plans on the idea that oil would be over $100 a barrel forevermore. And I think that Minsky moment, when we realized that the high price of oil ends up encouraging alternatives, whether the Canadian tar sands, the U.S. shale production, or Russia, or the deep underwater finds in, say, off the coast of Brazil. The high price of oil alone breeds the opposite. Same thing, I think, that's true on the downside. That is to say, the drop in commodity prices will, over time, push out production, reduce capacity, and that can be done through mergers and acquisitions, failures, no more credit to some of these oil producers. And eventually, it will set the stage for the recovery in prices, just like the big boom in commodity prices peaking in around 2008, what did farmers do? They saw high prices for commodities, so they produced more of them. That drove the price down. So the seeds of this downturn, of this collapse in commodity prices, was really in the upturn, was really in the boom. And this collapse in commodity prices will, over time, and I'm not smart enough to know exactly when, I'm not even smart to know about when, but eventually, the drop in prices, people respond to that incentive structure, and they're going to pull back capacity. Mergers, acquisitions, failures, no more credit.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one last question on the first theme that you had outlined years ago, and that's the divergent monetary policies. And the reason is because we've finally seen the Fed hike interest rates by 25 basis points, just a small move. Of course, we have seen tightening when we look at the increase in the dollar, the appreciation of the dollar that has tightened the liquidity as well. But do you think that this divergence, which appears to be continuing and growing wider, will precipitate a crisis this year when we look at the amount of dollar-denominated debt in the emerging markets, which you cited? And seems this continued move by the Federal Reserve to hike interest rates this year, are they, do you think, going to bring about a crisis of their own undoing?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure what crisis really means. In some ways, beginning in, say, the Mexican crisis, currency crisis, 94-95, through the Asian financial crisis, 97, 98, and then into the Brazil, Russia, those were rigid currency regimes that were breaking. It was like a dam bursting. So while I recognize, of course, the pressure on emerging market currencies, I'm not sure that it alone is the crisis or the economics of the crisis. Perhaps what we're seeing is that the economic and financial challenges are producing a political backlash. That's what we're seeing in parts of, say, Southern Europe, where after pressure for austerity, the Southern Europe, Greece, Spain, Portugal, France, have elected governments who are reluctant to have more austerity. So by that I mean that the currencies in the emerging market space that have been hit the hardest are not just those with weak economic fundamentals, but those countries that also have some kind of political problem, whether it's Brazil, where the president is under impeachment proceedings, where they fired a finance minister who was respected by the markets. Similar thing in South Africa. Political problems. Turkey, Hungary. Now Poland, they elected a center-right government that's sort of moving more on the illiberal, that is, say, more towards Hungary and Turkey than moving closer to, say, Western Europe. And so it seems to me that countries that have just economic problems, pressure on the currency, like Mexico, for example, the Mexican peso is at record lows. Is this a crisis for Mexico? I don't think so. I don't think they necessarily like this. And remember, shortly after the Fed raised rates last month, so did Mexico. But in general, I'd say those countries that have both economic and political challenges, that's, I would say, are the most likely candidates for a crisis. Just economic problems, they can usually be dealt with, even though it causes some strain. And remember, in a country that's having a weak economic growth or low inflation, a weaker currency is part of the solution, not part of the problem. It's really the pace of that, and the currency weakness represents a loss of confidence by investors. So Mexico is an interesting case where it's got a weaker currency, but I wouldn't say it's a crisis. Brazil, weak currency, probably closer to a crisis.
We've been speaking to Mark Chandler, Global Head of Currency Strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman. Mark, thank you very much for coming on to Financial Sense NewsHour and speaking with our audience.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's always an honor.
Now coming up next, the program you've all been waiting for, predictions for the year 2016, a time-honored tradition here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. And we have three parts to that. Number one, what the street consensus is. Number two, what all of the rogues out there are thinking, those people who have outlier positions. And finally, what does Jim think about the coming year? We'll divide that this week and next week. The first two this week, the last part, the Financial Sense predictions next week. And that's all going to follow coming up next as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.